Hello, this is Shelby with another episode of Workings of the Townships on CJMQ 88.9 FM. This week, I'll be talking about job extinction. Throughout history, there has been several jobs that have been lost and created due to technological advancements, environmental issues, market changes, consumer habits, government regulations, and global phenomena. Now, the workings of the townships focus on the resource sector in the townships, but this week I will be stepping out a little into new territories and looking at job shifts in different sectors and areas of Canada. But don't you worry, I'll be bringing it back home by the end of the show. Well, first of all, I think it's pretty crazy to think that most of the jobs we work now didn't exist once upon a time, and that jobs from once upon a time don't exist now. Who could have anticipated 200 years ago that jobs like web designers or Instagram influencers or drone pilots would exist today? I mean, it's even a bit difficult for me to comprehend that there's someone sitting in a military base in Nevada who can fight a war all the way in Iraq using an unmanned drone. So, let's go back in time and see how jobs have transformed over the years. So I want you to close your eyes. And if you're driving, well, just let Jesus take the wheel. And imagine a time before cell phones, a time before alarm clocks, and a place without any roosters. How would you get up in the morning? Who would wake you? Well, a knocker-up. That's who. So a knocker-up was popular in England and Ireland as a job during the Industrial Revolution all the way up to the 1950s. What a knocker-upper would do is, well, you guessed it, they would knock to get people up. Usually they would go out around 5 or 6 in the morning, go around with a long stick to tap their clients' windows until they would get up. Mary Smith, a famous knocker-up, had a pea shooting method. She'd shoot peas at your window using a pea shooter. Oh, the things that we miss out on nowadays. There ain't nothing like being woken up to peas being pelted at your window by Miss Mary Smith. So after alarm clocks became popular and affordable, people like Miss Mary Smith went out of business. To this day, there is one question that still remains unanswered about this job. The mystery weighs heavily on society. So, answer this. If knocker-ups woke up others, then who woke up the knocker-ups? We may never know. Another thing to ponder is, how did people get news prior to the invention of the radio, television, and the internet? Well, back in the day, they used town criers, or also known as bellmen. These men would go into bustling public squares and proclaim important news of the day. They gracefully yelled out local bylaws, proclamations, and adverts. They could be found all over the world. For example, in Goslar, Germany, a bellman would be hired to give a friendly reminder not to urinate or defecate in the river the day before water was to be drawn for brewing beer. This practice has a long history. It started in ancient Greece and was largely phased out in the early 20th century, in part because of the growth of local newspapers and literacy rates. And if you're a fan of the art of criering, I don't know if that's a real word, but we'll use it here today, you can check out the many World Town Crier tournaments that happen throughout the world. Many are hosted in England. Now, doesn't everyone love a good game of bowling? Well, kind of. I don't, but I know others who do. So in an age before automatic pin setups, there once was a time where you could walk into an alley full of pin boys and indoor smoking. These pin boys would manually set up your pins. Now, I don't always bowl, but when I do, mine are usually left standing, so they wouldn't have to have worked hard in my lane. But unfortunately, these workers were left pinless and penniless in the advent of new technology. But if you want to relive this experience, there are still a few vintage bowling alleys left in America, such as Holler House in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. It was built in 1908, and it is one of the oldest certified bowling lanes in America. And what about those lamplighters? Don't forget about the lamplighters. Those people who lit the street lamps at dusk. The superficial light allowed people to see where they were going. Different fuels were used to burn, such as whale blubber and kerosene. Some little fun facts about whale blubber was it was also used in margarine, yummy, as transmission fluid, and in World War I, the British would rub the oil on their feet to prevent trench foot. Believe it or not. All right, when burning this fuel light, it also gave a very unpleasant odor. And when it was replaced in the 19th century by kerosene, which is a cheaper and longer-lasting fuel, people rejoiced because they no longer had to smell burning whale fat. By the late 19th century and throughout the 20th century, electricity replaced gas lamps, and the good old lamplighters were no longer needed. We can also see disappearances in jobs in Quebec and other provinces concerning the log driver. And I'm sure many of you have heard about this profession. Now, the log driver would shepherd fallen logs down streams and rivers to sawmills. The process to get the logs to the bodies of water would begin in fall. Loggers would go into the bush to build camps and clear roads for transporting timber. Throughout winter, they would cut down trees, and with horse-drawn sleds, they would haul timber to the riverbanks. The cold climate would make it easier to fall trees, since the sap was no longer running, and the snow roads would ease the hauling of logs. With the coming of the thaw, so in the springtime, the timber drive began, and they would open their creek side dams that they built during the winter to flush the logs as best as they could from the creek bed to the river. They would then tie these big logs up in order to make a raft, and on them they would travel down hundreds of miles downstream, geared with spiked shoes and pevies. And pevies are these long wooden staffs with hooks at the end. Every time they came to rapids, they would have to break their rafts up and shoot the logs through. Their food and gear would have to be portaged around white waters, and then they would have to catch up to the logs and reassemble their raft. They did this till they reached the mills. This was very dangerous work. You would have to be hardy, brave, and have better balance than a yogi master to do this job. These men would work around 14 hours a day, if not more, standing in icy water, wearing soaking wet clothes day in and day out. One misstep could lead a man to his death. Falling into fast water between heavy timber can crush the strongest man. But the worst danger was log jams. Logs can get stuck in the shallow waters or on rocks, which could lead to buildups. that can take weeks to break up. Many men risk their lives to break them up by prying them apart with their pevies or using dynamite. Newspapers would be full of reports about accidents and deaths that happened during the log drive. For example, in 1845, there were 80 reported deaths during the log driving season in Ottawa Valley alone. Log driving took place in Canada long before Canada was even considered a country. In the Ottawa Valley, this activity dates back to the early 19th century. It even occurred at the time of New France on the Richelieu River. If you were around for the days of the $1 bill, then you might remember seeing the featured picture of the log drive. It showed a tugboat traveling across the log-covered Ottawa River. And in the background, you can see the Parliament building. At the time, the Upper Ottawa Improvement Company ran the log driving operations on the Ottawa. It was established in 1868 and finished in 1999. It wasn't the first company to go. Log driving started to diminish in the 1970s, beginning in Lake Timiskaming in northeastern Ontario, and most other regions of Quebec, ending operations in the 90s, such as the Livret River. Many things had led to the discontinuation of log driving operations, such as the decline in pulp and paper industries, public opinion, technological innovations, environmental laws, and recycling regulations. For example, technological developments such as the railway, trucks, and other machinery reduced crew sizes and operations, as well as the advent of recycling. In 1994, U.S. states increasingly insisted that any newsprint must contain a certain content of recycled paper. Following this, the U.S. House of Representatives passed a bill that required all newspapers with circulation of 200,000 or more to use newsprint containing 50% recycled paper or better. The effects of this was felt across the border. For example, at the Gatineau pulp mill, they adjusted operations to accommodate this legislation and was able to make pulp from a 60-40 combination of virgin wood and recycled newsprint. Demand for wood decreased and in turn reduced the size of the log drive. For some companies, as much as 40%, and made operations uneconomical. This is a shining example of how interconnected countries' economies are and how domestic laws can have international repercussions. Bringing it back to the eastern townships, we can also see how environmental laws, public opinion, health concerns, and market prices led to the closure of the Jeffrey Mine in 2011. I'm sure many of you already know about the Jeffrey Mine, but for those who don't, it was an asbestos mine that opened in 1879, and it has a long and interesting history. It was the site of the notorious 1949 asbestos strike, and it was the biggest asbestos mine in the world at a time. It supported local economies for decades, and when the dangers of asbestos exposure became well known to the world, its operation ceased. And the last I heard was the town of Asbestos is in the process of changing the name in order to make it more marketable to the outside world. But this is a story for another time. And if you or someone you know has knowledge about the Jeffrey Mine and would like to share their experiences, then please contact me at workingsofthetownships@gmail.com. Once again, workingsofthetownships@gmail.com. So, thanks for joining me, and I will leave you with a song called The Jam on Jerry's Rock by the Waccamaw Wailers. If you have never heard of this band, the Waccamaw Wailers, they are a Canadian band that started in the 1980s by four employees at the Waccamaw Lake Provincial Park. They interpret Canada's colorful history into folk songs. This song illustrates the dangerous life of the log drivers back in the day. I hope you enjoy. This has been the Workings of the Townships with Shelby. Till next time.
Come all you boy, young shanty boys, and here as I relate, concerning a young river boss and his untimely fate. Concerning a young river boss, so handsome, true and brave, 'twas on the jam on Jerry's Rock he met his watery grave. 'Twas on a Sunday morning, as well you all will hear, our jam was piled mountains high, we could not keep it clear. Our foreman cried, turn out brave men with hearts devoid of fear, and smash the jam on Jerry's Rock, for Ellingston will steer. Some of the boys were willing, while others they were not, to work on jams on Sunday they did not think they ought. Till six of our Canadian boys all volunteered to go and smash the jam on Jerry's Rock, with their foreman young Monroe. They had not rolled off many logs till they heard his young voice say, I'll have you boys be on your guard, this jam will soon give way. His words were scarcely spoken when the jam did break and go, and it carried off the Canadian lads and their foreman young Monroe. Those brave shanty boys, the sad news they did hear, in search of their brave comrades to the riverside did steer. Meanwhile their mangled bodies a-floating down did go, while dead and bleeding on the bank lay the corpse of young Monroe. They buried him in sorrow's depths. 'Twas on the 1st of May, on a green bank by the riverside, there grew a hemlock gray. Inscribed in that gray hemlock by the riverside did grow, was the name and date of this sad fate of our foreman young Monroe.